He was pleased to see that his hand was not trembling. The door opened.
"Shadow!"
"Hi," said Shadow. He stayed sitting down. Chernobog walked into the room. He was carrying a folded copy of the Chicago Sun-Times, which he put down on the coffee table. He stared at Shadow. Then he put his hand out, tentatively. The two men shook hands.
"I came," said Shadow. "Our deal. You came through with your part of it. This is my part."
Chernobog nodded. His brow creased. The sunlight glinted on his gray hair and mustache, making them appear almost golden. He frowned.
"Is not..."
He broke off.
"Maybe you should go. It's not a good time."
"Take as long as you need," said Shadow. "I'm ready." Chernobog sighed.
"You are a very stupid boy. You know that?"
"I guess."
"You are a stupid boy. And on the mountain top, you did a very good thing."
"I did what I had to do."
"Perhaps."
Chernobog walked to the old wooden sideboard and, bending down, pulled an attaché case from underneath it. He flipped the catches on the case. Each one sprang back with a satisfying thump. He opened the case. He took a hammer out and hefted it experimentally. The hammer looked like a scaled-down sledgehammer. Its wooden haft was stained. Then he stood up. He said,
"I owe you much, more than you know. Because of you, things are changing. This is springtime, the true spring."
"I know what I did," said Shadow. "I didn't have a lot of choice." Chernobog nodded. There was a look in his eyes that Shadow did not remember seeing before.
"Did I ever tell you about my brother?"
"Bielobog?" Shadow walked to the center of the ash-stained carpet. He went down on his knees. "You said you hadn't seen him in a long time."
"Yes," said the old man, raising the hammer. "It has been a long winter, boy, a very long winter. But the winter is ending now."
And he shook his head slowly, as if he were remembering something. And he said,
"Close your eyes."
Shadow closed his eyes and raised his head, and he waited. The head of the sledgehammer was cold, icy cold, and it touched his forehead as gently as a kiss.
"Pok! There," said Chernobog. "It's done."
There was a smile on his face that Shadow had never seen before, an easy, comfortable smile, like sunshine on a summer's day. The old man walked over to the case, and he put the hammer away and closed the bag and pushed it back under the sideboard.
"Chernobog?"
asked Shadow. Then,
"Are you Chernobog?"
"Yes, for today," said the old man. "By tomorrow, it will all be Bielobog, but today is still Chernobog."
"Then why? Why didn't you kill me when you could?" The old man took out an unfiltered cigarette from a packet in his pocket. He took a large box of matches from the mantelpiece and lit the cigarette with a match. He seemed deep in thought.
"Because," said the old man after some time, "there is blood, but there is also gratitude. And it has been a long, long winter."
Shadow got to his feet.
There were dusty patches on the knees of his jeans where he had knelt, and he brushed the dust away.
"Thanks," he said.
"You're welcome," said the old man. "Next time you want to play checkers, you know where to find me. This time, I play white."
"Thanks. Maybe I will," said Shadow. "But not for a while." He looked into the old man's twinkling eyes, and he wondered if they had always been that cornflower shade of blue. They shook hands, and neither of them said goodbye. Shadow kissed Zorya Utranyaya on the cheek on his way out, and he kissed Zorya Vechernyaya on the back of her hand. And he took the stairs out of that place, two at a time.
Postscript. Reykjavik in Iceland is a strange city. Even for those who have seen many strange cities, it is a volcanic city. The heat for the city comes from deep underground. There are tourists, but not as many of them as you might expect, not even in early July. The sun was shining as it had shone for weeks now. It ceased shining for an hour or two in the small hours of the morning. There would be a dusky dawn of sorts between 2 and 3 in the morning, and then the day would begin once more. The big tourist had walked most of Reykjavik that morning, listening to people talk in a language that had changed little in 1,000 years. The natives here could read the ancient sagas as easily as they could read a newspaper. There was a sense of continuity on this island that scared him and that he found desperately reassuring. He was very tired. The unending daylight had made sleep almost impossible, and he had sat in his hotel room through the whole long nightless night, alternately reading a guidebook and Bleak House, a novel he had bought in an airport in the last few weeks, but which airport he could no longer remember. Sometimes he had stared out of the window. Finally, the clock, as well as the sun, proclaimed it morning. He bought a bar of chocolate at one of the many candy stores and walked the sidewalk, occasionally finding himself reminded of the volcanic nature of Iceland. He would turn a corner and notice for a moment a sulphurous quality to the air. It put him in mind not of Hades, but of rotten eggs. Many of the women he passed were very beautiful, slender and pale, the kind of women that Wednesday had liked. Shadow wondered what could have attracted Wednesday to Shadow's mother, who had been beautiful, but had been neither of those things. Shadow smiled at the pretty women because they made him feel pleasantly male. And he smiled at the other women, too, because he was having a good time. He was not sure when he became aware that he was being observed. Somewhere on his walk through Reykjavik, he became certain that someone was watching him. He would turn from time to time, trying to get a glimpse of who it was, and he would stare into store windows and out at the reflected street behind him, but he saw no one out of the ordinary, no one who seemed to be observing him. He went into a small restaurant, where he ate smoked puffin and cloudberries and Arctic char and boiled potatoes, and he drank Coca-Cola, which tasted sweeter, more sugary than he remembered it tasting back in the States. When the waiter brought his bill, he said,
"Excuse me, you are American?"
"Yes."
"Then happy 4th of July, said the waiter. He looked pleased with himself.
Shadow hadn't realized that it was the 4th, Independence Day.
Yes.
He liked the idea of independence. He left the money and a tip on the table and walked outside. There was a cool breeze coming in off the Atlantic, and he buttoned up his coat. He sat down on a grassy bank and looked at the city that surrounded him and thought one day he would have to go home. And one day he would have to make a home to go back to. He wondered whether home was a thing that happened to a place after a while, or if it was something that you found in the end, if you simply walked and waited, and willed it long enough. An old man came striding across the hillside toward him. He wore a dark gray cloak, ragged at the bottom, as if he had done a lot of traveling. And he wore a broad-brimmed blue hat with a seagull feather tucked into the band at a jaunty angle. He looked like an aging hippie, thought Shadow, or a long-retired gunfighter. The old man was ridiculously tall. The man squatted beside Shadow on the hillside. He nodded curtly to Shadow. He had a piratical black eye patch over one eye and a jutting white chin beard. Shadow wondered if the man was going to hit him up for a cigarette. The old man said something in a foreign tongue.
"I'm sorry," said Shadow. "I don't speak Icelandic."
Then he said, awkwardly, the phrase he had learned from his phrase book in the daylight of the small hours of that morning.
"Yesh tala bara ensko."
"I speak only English, and then American." The old man nodded slowly. He said, "My people went from here to America a long time ago. They went there, and then they returned to Iceland. They said it was a good place for men, but a bad place for gods. And without their gods, they felt too alone." His English was fluent, but the pauses and the beats of the sentences were strange. Shadow looked at him. Close up, the man seemed older than Shadow had imagined possible. His skin was lined with tiny wrinkles and cracks, like the cracks in granite. The old man said, "I do know you, boy."
"You do?"
"You and I, we have walked the same path. I also hung on the tree for 9 days, a sacrifice of myself to myself. I am the Lord of the Ease. I am the god of the gallows."
"You are Odin," said Shadow.
The man nodded thoughtfully, as if weighing up the name.
"They call me many things, but yes, I am Odin, Bor's son," he said.
"I saw you die," said Shadow. "I stood vigil for your body. You tried to destroy so much for power. You would have sacrificed so much for yourself. You did that."
"I did not do that."
"Wednesday did. He was you."
"He was me, yes, but I am not him."
The man scratched the side of his nose. His gull feather bobbed.
"Will you go back?" asked the Lord of the Gallows. "To America?"
"Nothing to go back for," said Shadow. As he said it, he knew it was a lie.
"Things wait for you there," said the old man. "But they will wait until you return."
A white butterfly flew crookedly past them. Shadow said nothing. He had had enough of gods and their ways to last him several lifetimes. He would take the bus to the airport, he decided, and change his ticket, get a plane to somewhere he had never been. He would keep moving.
"Hey," said Shadow, "I have something for you."
His hand dipped into his pocket and palmed the object he needed. "Hold your hand out," he said. Odin looked at him strangely and seriously. Then he shrugged and extended his right hand, palm down. Shadow reached over and turned it so the palm was upward. He opened his own hands, showed them one after the other to be completely empty. Then he pushed the glass eye into the leathery palm of the old man's hand and left it there.
"How did you do that?"
"Magic," said Shadow, without smiling. The old man grinned and laughed and clapped his hands together. He looked at the eye, holding it between finger and thumb, and nodded as if he knew exactly what it was, and then he slipped it into a leather bag that hung by his waist.
"Tak kyalega."
"I shall take care of this."
"You're welcome," said Shadow. He stood up, brushed the grass from his jeans.
"Again,"
said the Lord of Asgard, with an imperious motion of his head, his voice deep and commanding.
"More! Do it again!"
"You people," said Shadow, "you're never satisfied. Okay, this is one I learned from a guy who's dead now." He reached into nowhere, and took a gold coin from the air. It was a normal sort of gold coin. It couldn't bring back the dead or heal the sick, but it was a gold coin, sure enough. "And that's all there is," he said, displaying it between finger and thumb. "That's all she wrote." He tossed the coin into the air with a flick of his thumb. It spun golden at the top of its arc in the sunlight, and it glittered and glinted and hung there in the midsummer sky as if it was never going to come down. Maybe it never would. Shadow didn't wait to see. He walked away, and he kept on walking.
The End. You've been listening to American Gods by Neil Gaiman, narrated by George Guidel. While this book was in production at the Recorded Book Studios in New York, Neil Gaiman paid us a visit to talk about his successful career as a writer. That interview can be found on the final disc. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Blind Eye by James B. Stewart, narrated by Richard Poe, and Cod, a biography of the fish that changed the world, by Mark Kurlansky, narrated by Richard M. Davidson. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So to order another recorded book, or for a copy of our latest listing, please call us using the toll-free number found on the back of the book. You can order by phone with any major credit card, or by writing to us, or by faxing us. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, place orders, or tune into narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Recorded Books Incorporated presents The Author Talks, a conversation with Neil Gaiman. Neil Gaiman is the author of Neverwhere, Stardust, Smoke and Mirrors, The Day I Swapped My Dad for Two Goldfish, and the Sandman series. In the spring of 2001, while American Gods was in production at the Recorded Book Studio in New York, Neil Gaiman paid us a visit to talk about the writing of his books. The following is his conversation with Denise Longto, host of The Author Talks.
Today in the studios of Recorded Books, high above 22nd Street, with the Empire State Building just a stone's throw away, we're delighted to have the award-winning, best-selling author Neil Gaiman here with us today. Welcome, Neil, and thank you for visiting with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
I understand you're on your way to Rio by way of London. Is that true, and you just happened to stop by 22nd Street?
This was my stopover in New York. Yes, we arranged this trip to go via Newark.
Well, we'd like to thank you for coming here today. Why don't we begin with a discussion about your latest novel, which, as we speak, is about to be released into the real world, American Gods. Can you tell us what the genesis of the idea for your novel was?
Like, I think, probably most novels, or at least most big, thick novels, it came from three or four different things coming together and suddenly going, oh my God, that's a novel, that moment of confluence. I know the moment it started, and the moment it started was lying in bed one night and imagining two men meeting on an aeroplane and just thinking, well, what would have happened if one of them had just got out of prison and he's been bounced backwards and forwards, there's been a storm, his flight's been cancelled, he's now on some flight that he never started off on. He's not even in the seat he was meant to be. He's bounced up to the one empty seat in first class, and he sits down, and the man in the seat next to him turns to him and says, you're late, do you want a job? I'm offering you a job. And that was really where it started, that moment in chapter one. And I'd think about it before I went to sleep, and I'd wonder who these men were and why they'd met and how the older one had known that the younger one needed a job and all that kind of thing. I wasn't quite sure. I really didn't know. These were just these two characters in the back of my head. And then there was an idea that I had for a car that gets parked out on the ice every winter, which was inspired by being around the Midwest a lot, you know, having a home out near Minneapolis, and getting to see a number of places where they do things like park a car on the ice for charity every winter, and you know, you get to make bets on when it will go through for the local Lions Club or Rotary or whatever. And just thinking this was so strange. I mean, coming from England, where water doesn't actually even get hard in the winter, the discovery that lakes have their own sort of strange ecology fascinated me. And I kept thinking about this in connection with a murder mystery and wondering if that was part of the same story as these two men. And then in 1998, it was June of 1998, I was going to Norway and then to Finland and Denmark, doing this little sort of Scandinavian book signing tour, so on and so forth. But I had one day's holiday, and it was a day's holiday as a stopover in Iceland. Because if you fly from Minneapolis to Iceland, they give you a free stopover there. You can stay in Reykjavik as long as you want. And I thought, what a great idea. And I got onto a plane at 7:30 at night. And the plane actually, because it nips over the pole, only takes about 5 hours to get to Reykjavik. So at about midnight, local time, American time, which was also 6 o'clock in the morning, Reykjavik time, I got off the plane into Reykjavik by 7:30-ish. And I thought, well, there's no real point in going to bed at 7:30 in the morning. I'll stay up until it gets dark. And this was July 5th or 6th, and you don't get dark in Iceland at that time. So I got maybe half an hour's sleep that night. And the following day, by which point I was starting to feel like an experiment in sleep deprivation, I remember wandering the streets of Reykjavik, wondering what happened to the gods, and thinking about the people going out from Iceland to Vinland, going off and going to America, and wondering if their gods went with them. And all of a sudden, the whole of American gods fell into place. And I went back to my hotel room, and I wrote a 2 or 3 page letter to my editor and to my agent saying, okay, this is the book, and it'll be called American Gods, and this is a little description of it. Although the book itself grew enormously in the telling, the brief description that I gave of the book back then was the book that I then set out to write.
What surprised you the most in your creative journey along the way of writing the novel?
I think the thing that surprised me the most, partly, of course, it was always the plot, because writing, for me, is a little like being a stage magician, only you don't let yourself know which hand the coins are really in. There's a level on which I almost pretend to myself that I don't know where the plot is going. And on some deep, basic level, I do. I can go back and look at my notebooks, and it's very obvious that I did. But the moments of serendipity, the joyful things that you find on the way. Cairo, Illinois, I think, is a lovely example of that, where while I was researching the book, I did a road trip from Wisconsin down to Florida, going via a bunch of places that I thought my characters might want to go on the way. And I found myself at one point heading into Cairo, Illinois. This wonderful place. It's this strange place of confluence. It's where these two rivers come together, where the Ohio joins the Mississippi. And it's a very shabby town. You can see there were former glories, that at one point when the river traffic was important, this was a very important town, and no longer true. And it's Little Egypt. And it just suddenly occurred to me that that was where I wanted my Egyptian gods to be. And chapter 8, which is the one set in Cairo, is my favorite chapter in the book. It was the most fun to write. It was this wonderful sort of little break from everything. And I really didn't know it was going to be there when I set out to write the book. It was just all of a sudden it happened and it was perfect.
Once the pantheon of gods became the fodder for your imagination, how did you begin to whittle down or pick the particular gods, seeing as you have Hindu gods, Egyptian gods, you have gods of many, many cultures and belief systems?
There wasn't a lot of picking. If anything, they decided which ones they wanted to be in the book. They chose. There were definitely lists of gods that I made at the beginning of the book, many of whom just didn't get into it because they didn't work in. And the ones that did turn up, often weren't the people I thought they were going to be when I had them in my head. Easter's a lovely example. I had Easter pegged from the moment that I began the book as major possible romantic interest for Book, and I thought she was going to be in a lot more than she was, and I thought she was going to get on stage a lot earlier and be this wonderful sort of gorgeous femme fatale vamp kind of character. And she wasn't. I love her very much. I mean, she's one of my favorite characters in the book, but she wasn't going to come on stage until she was ready. And she certainly wasn't a love interest. She got, she did her bit on the stage and she got off again. But she was one of the very few that I knew were going to be in there from the word go. Partly because it's always amused and fascinated me that you have this Easter festival. And it's named after her, Eostra of the Dawn. That was her name. Her festival was celebrated with symbols of fertility like eggs and rabbits. And we still celebrate it. And it's still named after her. It's just, nobody knows that she was a person anymore, which seemed to me in some ways almost more heartbreaking than some of the other forgotten gods I've put in there. Chernobog is now only known through a Disney cartoon. He's the original Fantasia. He's the big black thing that turns up at the end of Night on Bald Mountain. Ah, that's Chernobog.
Your book is dense with ideas. If there were a central idea or one thing that you would like your listeners or readers to come away from after hearing your book, what would it be?
I think if there was one central idea that I could have put into that book, it would have been so much shorter and easier a book. The thing about American Gods is I actually wanted to try and recreate for the reader, in some ways, what it felt like for me as somebody coming to this country really about 8 years ago, was when I moved out here mostly to live, back and forward to England a certain amount. But essentially I've been living here since 1990. 1992. And it's such a huge country and it contains so many things. And I wanted to try and squeeze a little bit of the ways that the magnificent set of contradictions that comprise this enormous and wonderful and completely bizarre country into a book, which I think is one reason why, you know, the book was a year late. And it wasn't a year late because I was off doing other things and faffing around. It was a year late because it was twice as long as I thought it was going to be to write. And it was twice as long because it was a much bigger story and because trying to squeeze even a fraction of America into a book is a strange thing. And if I'd had another 5 years, I probably would have written a book very similar, but 2,000 pages long, with a lot more of those historical vignettes where you get a sense of people coming to America over the years and bringing their gods with them. I would have done the story in the Japanese West Coast internment camps. Some years ago, there's a writer named Dawson, Richard Dawson, who is a folklorist, who I actually quote at the beginning of American Gods. And I remember once reading a book of his where he talked about how when the Japanese were rounded up and put into the internment camps, these horrible places, a lot of Japanese folklore started re-emerging, and you'd get cases of fox spirit possession and women seeing badgers and things like that. And I thought that would make a lovely story to tell in context, again, of American Gods. And at the end of the day, I didn't have time. And also, by the end of the book, I was going through cutting out chunks, trying to whittle it back down.
Did it become a picaresque novel by virtue of the fact you were trying to say so much and really span not only territory, but the territory of ideas?
Yes, and also geographical territory. There's a joke, not a funny one, the other kind, about the difference between England and America, which is that England is a country in which 100 miles is a long way, and America is a country in which 100 years is a long time. And I've always been fascinated by that. When I wrote Neverwhere, my first real novel, although in many ways I think American Gods is actually my first real novel. But when I wrote Neverwhere, there's definitely the idea that you're going down, and it's a descent that not only occurs in physical terms, but in temporal terms too. You are going back in time in some way. With America, I've always had this idea that in England, you can find whatever you want. If you're a writer and you want a subject and you want to find something, all you have to do is go back far enough and it'll be there somewhere. Whereas with America, all you have to do is drive far enough and you'll get there eventually. You know, it's out there somewhere. So by definition, I think it had to be a road novel, which meant that by definition, it was a picaresque, which then as a novelist became structurally a nightmare because I not only wanted to do something that was a picaresque and a road novel, but I also wanted to build this little town of Lakeside and create that for him. And for the first 6, 7, 8 chapters, I still wasn't quite sure how I was going to get him to Lakeside and still keep the road novel going.
Did you go back, not that you needed to, and look at any sort of famous picaresque or road novels in the genre?
No, I very much didn't. I figured that the lovely thing about picaresque is it's a structure that's in there in the back of your head. Because basically it's the simplest and most wonderful basic structure there can be for a novel, which is you go on the road and stuff happens. It's the Odyssey.
How did you land in Minnesota?
I married many, many years ago in England, a very nice American lady to whom I am still married. And we had children. And then after about 10 years of marriage, I think she rather liked the idea of her side of the family meeting the kids. And I, at the time, all of my income was coming in dollars. And the exchange rate was going up and down like nobody's business. And I, being living any kind of freelance lifestyle is weird enough anyway, without the added stress of having no idea of whether $2,000 that you just got in will actually be worth £1,000 or £1,500 when you come to cash the check. And I said to my wife, I said, well, look, if you can find me an Adams family house. I've always wanted to live in an Adams family house, ever since I was about 7 years old and got a copy of The Penguin Charles Adams and looked at those houses and thought, I want one of those. I said, if you can find me one, I will move. And she went over to Minneapolis, flew in, and came back 3 days later and said, right, I found your house.
And in some ways, your being here transplanted and seeing this new land through new eyes has been a gift to your imagination.
I think every writer should feel like an alien as much as possible. I'm starting to feel a little too comfortable here. Now that I've actually finished American Gods and I've been here for years, I'm starting to think, well, maybe it would be nice to go somewhere else where I feel a little more odd and out of it again. Because it's a very good feeling for a writer. It keeps you nervous. It keeps you awake. But the flip side of that also is it gives you a whole new batch of things to learn. Which, as a writer, I mean, coming into the Midwest, I knew nothing about the Midwest. I knew nothing about the idea of how cold the winters can get. You know, I'd say to people, oh, yeah, moving out to Minneapolis. And they'd say, oh, it gets very cold there in the winters. And I'd think, right, yeah, I've been snowed on. I know what it's like. I didn't have a clue, which was why I had such fun writing Poor Shadow, setting off in minus 30-degree weather and suddenly discovering that this is not something wise or sensible to do. And also I got to research all sorts of things, not even knowing that I was researching, just wanting to know about them. I came over here and people would mention things like Johnny Appleseed, and I'd go off and buy my books and research these people just to find out who they were, and very often find that the real story of what happened behind them was much more interesting than the sort of the fake lore, the stuff that isn't quite folklore, but that people believe.
Now for the big question. Do you think we're living in godless times, or the gods that we do have in terms of contemporary society that you talk about in the book are actually hollow gods?
When I started writing the book, I thought that. And when I started writing the book, I thought that I was going to draw a sort of demarcation line in the sand, and there would be good guys and bad guys in this novel, and it would be very clear who was who, and the old gods would be the good guys, and the new gods, these television and internet gods, would definitely be the bad guys. That was definitely how I started the book. That was the position I started it from. The trouble with writing a book like this for 2 years is you have to think about this stuff an awful lot. And by the time I finished the first draft of the novel, it was very obvious that that wasn't really necessarily the case. It was also very obvious that it would probably be a better thing to be one of the old gods than to be one of the new gods. Because the new gods get eaten very, very quickly. The new gods get forgotten very, very quickly. You know, even just watching the speed with which the whole dot-com thing collapsed was fascinating. Looking at the 19th century new gods, the trains, the telegraph, they've almost been forgotten now. And I tend to think, you know, telephone gods and television gods, it may be the same for them. If I was them, I'd feel very nervous. I would feel very uncomfortable.
You'd probably want to be a fiber optic god.
Yes, but even then, for how long is it going to be, you know, it's the day that everything turns completely wireless and all these fiber optic gods are just sort of going, oh, well.
Then we'll have to go back to nature, I'm afraid.
Exactly. But I loved writing all of my gods. I mean, that was the joy of it for me, was trying to see how many I could get in. Many years ago, when I was writing Sandman, I did a storyline called Season of Mists. And the plot of Season of Mists was very, very simple, which was that Lucifer is tired of running hell. He doesn't see any reason why he has to run hell. He doesn't enjoy it. It's not even interesting. And he quits. He empties, throws everybody out, locks the door behind him, goes away, gives the key to Morpheus, who is the Lord of Dreams, the lead character of the story, says, right, you know, here you go, it'll do you no good, and you are now in charge of hell. And at that point, the Sandman gets back to his castle and finds that he is suddenly the owner of the biggest and most important plot of psychic real estate there is, and everybody wants it. And I had an enormous amount of fun back then bringing on stage Egyptian gods, fairies, angels, comic book characters, the idea being everybody turned up and everybody wanted a piece of it. And while I was writing it, I kept expecting the whole suspension of disbelief mechanism to collapse. You know, you're asking people to believe, how many impossible things can you believe? And how can you possibly have all these different pantheons around and standing next to each other and interacting in the same environment? And what I discovered was they worked just fine. If you do them with belief, if you grant them a certain amount of credibility, they will look after you. So when I came to write American Gods, I knew that was going to work. That was one piece of the equation that I figured would definitely work, because I'd seen it work before, and I loved it. I love the feeling that you get when you get that moment where they're all going up the hill to Rock City and they've all gathered there. The moment, even when you've got them all at the House on the Rock, and just the idea that you can have Anansi, the African spider god, and Odin and Chernobog as these three grumpy old men. Anansi isn't that grumpy, but it was a delight.
Aside from your skill as a writer in pulling this off in terms of craft, what is it about these elements of gods, of mythologies, of fairies and fairy tales and angels that so appeals to us, even as adults?
I think they go in on a really, really primal level. And by primal, I mean an effect that works all the way down. You know, as far down as you can possibly get. They work. They affect you. There are rhythms in the stories. There is a reason why people have been telling each other these stories for hundreds of thousands of years. We assume, we know about thousands of years. I suspect it's, you know, as far back as people have been talking, they've been telling each other these stories. And they satisfy on a very, very primal level. Shadow himself as a character, his story, watching him die on the tree and bringing him back, was, I'd always assumed something like that was going to happen in the book. But when it actually happened, it's a much more powerful thing than ever I imagined before I'd written it, and before I actually looked down at what I'd written and how it had worked.
How would you say American Gods is a departure or a step for you in another direction in comparison to your two other novels, Neverwhere and Stardust? Is this a whole new chapter for you in terms of your writing, do you think?
Oh, God, I hope so. I mean, as a writer, you always want to feel that you're moving forward. American Gods has several things about it that are very different from the first two novels. And the first two novels are very different from each other. Neverwhere began life as a TV series. I wrote the scripts for a TV series. I wasn't really satisfied when we started filming with the way that the vision of the TV series had transferred, what I wanted in the scripts, the way that it was transferring to the screen. And I really wrote the novel on that in self-defense. It was my infinitely budgeted director's cut, if you see what I mean. And Neverwhere, at the end of the day, is an adventure story. Somebody once described it as Narnia on the Northern Line, which I thought was a lovely description. And in many ways, it's sort of like, yes, that's everything I wanted to do with it. It was an everyman hero and just a romp, which begins... Everything's very, very clear in it. I got to write Mr. Krupp and Mr. Vandermeer, who are wonderful villains. They're my favorite villains. I think I had more fun writing them than I've ever had writing any other villainous characters. And they are easily the most magnificently villainous of all the characters I've ever written. You know, just as the Marquis is the most magnificently duplicitous, and Richard is the blandest, and so on and so forth. They are all not said as a bad thing about any of them. They're all very one-dimensional. They don't go very deep. They're very thin characters, but they're delightful thin characters, and they're not meant to do anything else. They don't have, you know, they can't bear much weight, but nor are they meant to. They're perfect for what they are. Stardust was a fairy tale, and with Stardust, what I was very specifically trying to do was recreate the kind of feeling that you got from a kind of novel that was being written around the 1920s, before Tolkien had created fantasy as a viable genre, just at that point in time where you would get novelists who would go, oh, I think I'll write a fairy story, and they'd write it for adults because there was no reason not to. So in many ways, in Stardust, you have a strange phenomenon of the characters on one level being thinner, but on one level going much deeper and being more rounded. But they are fairy tale characters. With American Gods, it's not a fairy tale, and it's not an adventure story. It is a novel. It's a different brand of story. It's a different kind of thing. And it has two central characters in it, really, one of which is Shadow, and the other of which is America. So I get to describe both of them in many ways. And, you know, at the end of the novel, I was very aware of how little, how both of them really are almost iceberg-like. I don't get to show as much of Shadow as I wished, and I don't get to show quite as much of America as I would have wished in the novel. But I think in each case, you're looking at something where, unlike Stardust and Neverwhere, it wasn't written episodically. Each of those was written. Stardust was written in four parts originally for serial publication. Neverwhere was written in six parts. And there was the joy in each of them of having good guys and bad guys and of inventing worlds. What I tried to do in American Gods was, rather than invent a world, to describe a world, but to describe it using the metaphors of gods, of myth, of belief, in ways that I hope let you see things that you've never quite seen. The New York story, the taxi driver story. Back in October, I did some readings around America, raising money for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. And in New York, I did the reading in St. Mark's Church. And it was lovely, and it was sold out, and they were hanging from the rafters, which is always fun. And I thought, I have to read something from American Gods. I'll read the New York story, because it's New York. So I read that. And every now and then, I'll run into somebody who was there, and they'll say, you know, that story was so weird. I look at my cab drivers differently now. Whenever I'm in a cab, I wonder about the person in the front of the cab now. And I think, good. Add a little magic to their lives. I think that's part of the fun of a novel.
So I can't interview Neil Gaiman without talking about Sandman. I mean, there may be a few listeners out there who don't know about it, so I'll ask you in a moment to give a brief description of it, but let me simply forward that by saying it's a 10-volume series of graphic novels that have won you all sorts of awards. They're incredible bestsellers around the world, and they have even garnered you the World Fantasy Award, which I think is something you would sleep with at night if I had won it. So can you tell us, for those who are novices, a little bit about the Sandman series? Will you ever, like the Beatles, return to the Sandman series again? And is there going to be a movie at any point? I know it was in production and development.
Oh, it's always in development. I think the Sandman movie is living in development hell, and I'm perfectly happy for it to stay there forever. It's one of, every now and then they send me scripts, and they've been getting steadily worse since about 1993 when they first started sending me scripts. The Sandman is a, as you say, a 10-volume story. They're all in print as the Sandman Library. And when I asked the other day, was talking to my editor, I said, what's actually, how many have we now sold of these? What's the official sales thing? I said, you know, including all the book club editions and everything else, what do we actually sell? And she went away and she came back. She said, several million. And I said, can we be more precise than that? And she said, no, I don't think we can. It's several million. I said, so, several million. The strangest thing about Sandman, particularly at the time when we did it, was we were doing a story that was going to end somewhere. It was a 75-issue monthly comic book with a beginning, a very long middle, and an end, fairly long end, which at the time really nobody had done. There had been a few limited mini-series kind of things, but they normally didn't go longer than 12 issues. There's a guy called Dave Sim up in Canada who's been doing his comic Cerebus for about 20 years, and that is a story that has a beginning, middle, and an end, and is, I think, a good 2.5-3 years away from completion at this point. But Sandman was very much the first time a mainstream comic publisher had done anything like that. And when we began, they didn't know they were doing anything like that. I did, but I didn't tell them, because I figured that would make it a lot easier to get to where I wanted to get to. And by the time they got to the last few years, even they knew that, yes, they actually would do something that no comic publisher had ever done before, which is cancel a comic at the height of its sales. So by the time we got to issue 75, we were outselling Batman and Superman, and the story was done, and they finished us. As for going back, I did go back once, and I did a book called The Dream Hunters as a 10th anniversary thing, and I will probably go back every couple of years and do something, because it's always fun to go back and revisit those characters. The main problem that I have, though, is just how many hours there are in a day, how many days in a week, how many weeks in a year, and how much there is to get done. As you said, won an incredible number of awards for Sandman, which was very nice. The best thing about the World Fantasy Award was the morning after I'd won it, the secret masters of World Fantasy Awards held a conclave and decided that no more comics could ever get it, which I thought was not only like closing the stable door after the horse had bolted, but it was like closing the door after the horse had bolted and won the Kentucky Derby. And I don't sleep with it. It's sitting on a window ledge alongside a very small statue of Groucho Marx and a very small statue of the Bride of Frankenstein, and between the two of them is this H.P. Lovecraft Easter Island head, which is the World Fantasy Award. Magnificently ugly, and when my friend Dave McKean won his for Best Artist one year, he actually keeps his in this goldfish pool he has outside his office. This is a big goldfish pool, and you can just see H.P. Lovecraft's nose breaking the top of the water. It's very wonderful.
I'm not quite sure, just a little bit more about the Sandman. When I was reading up on you to prepare for this interview, they were described as graphic novels, which for me as an American sort of borders on graphic and sometimes mean pornography here. So how did you come to be called a graphic novelist, which I'm sure is of something of great esteem in England?
I don't think so. It's better than saying I write comics for adults, because then they really think that you're talking about people getting down and dirty. All right, the adult stuff. No, not the adult stuff. No, it's for grown-ups. So it's not adult. No, it's for grown-ups. I was very happy to say I wrote comics when people would say, what do you do? There was actually one occasion when I was at a dinner party. I don't go to many dinner parties, but I was at one. And I got chatting to a gentleman who I believe was the literary editor of the Sunday Telegraph at the time. And he said, what do you do? And I said, I write comics. And he looked rather disgruntled by this, as if he'd suddenly found himself talking to a dustman or something. But he said, putting a brave face on it, he said, oh, what kind of comics then? And I said, well, Sandman, Mr. Punch, just finished a thing called Signal to Noise in the Face. He said, oh, hang on, you're Neil Gaiman. And I said, well, yes, I am. He said, my dear fellow, you don't write comics, you write graphic novels. And I felt a lot like a hooker who'd just been told she was actually a lady of the evening. I don't mind. I mean, there has to be a term to distinguish something big and chunky that you can put on your bookshelf from a flimsy periodical. And, you know, graphic novels is as good a catchphrase as any. And when people grumble about it and say, well, some of these are only graphic novellas or even graphic novelettes. Look, there is a graphic short story. You sort of want to say, well, yes, you know what? A novel's aren't new anymore either. There's nothing particularly new about the novel. We've had them for 400 years now. Get over it.
So what are you working on now? I hope you're getting some sleep. Are you just on this whirlwind jaunt of a tour for American Gods?
It hasn't started yet, but it will. By the time people start buying the audiobooks and the books, I will be starting a tour. And that will be a hell tour. It's going to last about 5 weeks. Start in America, go over to England, come back and do Canada. And it's one of those things where it was only after the entire set of all of the days and all of the stores that I was signing in was set, and I looked down the list, I actually thought to phone the person who was organizing it, and I said, Jack, shouldn't there have been a day off in here somewhere?
Did you think when you began writing, I know you began as a journalist and then turned your pen to writing graphic novels, did you ever have an idea that someday there would be Neil Gaiman groupies?
Well, the idea of Neil Gaiman groupies, and actually there was one very nice one, young lady once, who actually did turn up at a signing. The signings are strange things. You have 400 or 500 people, you have several hours to get everybody signed, and you know, you just, all you hope is you will get back to your hotel by midnight, because you're going to have to be, you have an alarm call in for 6 o'clock the next morning because you have to get a cab out and get on the next plane to the next town. And I do remember a lady once, very nicely, got to the front of the line and she said, look, I only live around the corner. She said, if you want, you can come back to my flat and do whatever you want to me. And I had to say, well, that's terribly, terribly nice of you. Obviously, I appreciate the offer enormously, but there are 300 people here still to be signed. You know, who did you want that signed to again? And I signed her books, and she was on her way.
I guess I didn't mean to be.
So, yes, I'm afraid the literary groupie scene, it tends not actually to work very well. But no, did I ever imagine in my wildest dreams that I would get to be, I think Forbes magazine described me rather wonderfully as the most famous author in America that nobody's ever heard of, which I thought was a lovely way to be described, because if you know who I am, I'm terribly famous. If you don't know who I am, You haven't got any idea who I am. I'm either way on the radar or completely off the radar, which is a lovely place to be, because at that point you don't have the weird downside of fame, of people sort of tapping each other on the shoulder and saying, look, over there, eating dinner, that's Stephen King. Once having lunch with Stephen King and his family, people kept coming over with books for him to sign during lunch. And I thought, well, at least in my world, you know, yes, 300 people turn up for a signing. Or if I'm, you know, turning up here, an audiobook place, being interviewed, and several people have said, you know, I have books, can you sign them? And I say, yes, of course I will. That'll be fun. But you're sort of prepared for it. You have your author hat on at that point.
Where do you see yourself in 10 years, Neil?
I think everything I've done so far has been so astonishingly unlikely that even attempting to second-guess what the universe plans to deal out for me in the next 10 years.
Prime Minister?
Oh, when I was a kid, my aunt still tells the story. She was with me. It was a school open day, and some relatives were out. My aunt was there, and I was apparently a very precocious little kid. I must have been about 10. And some parent had come up and was asking some questions, and I was just going, oh, yes, well, and pop, 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 answering every question. And after a while, he looked down at me, he said, you know, you're a very, very bright young man. When you grow up, perhaps you'll be Prime Minister. And according to my aunt, I looked up at him with withering scorn and said, I very much hope I'll be something better than that. Thank you very much.
Can you describe a day in the life of Neil Gaiman? A day in the life as a writer, a day in the life on tour.
Yeah, that's the trouble. There are too many different days in the life. The best day in the life, my favorite days in the life, except that I missed my kids terribly, were during some of the American Gods writing periods when I would just take off. I borrowed houses from any friends I had with spare houses they weren't living in. And I have several friends who have houses in Florida they didn't live in. So I'd take off to Florida at one point. I took off to a friend's house in Ireland to finish the book and just wrap up some stuff. Those days are great because you sort of get up in the morning and you've been dreaming about the novel and it's still churning around in your head, and you go off and you have a little breakfast, and sometimes you check your email and sometimes you don't, and you pick up your pen and you fill it and you open the notebook that you're working in and you start to write. And that sort of goes on until suddenly you look up and you realize what time it is, and that was your day. It was there it happened. Food may have got eaten, and if you were good, you went for a walk, and if you weren't, you didn't. And those days are wonderful. I mean, I really love just the thing of going and living in that world. A normal day isn't like that. Normal days are get up, look at the mail, there is too much. Look at the email, there is too much. Try and answer hastily everything that I can, or deal with everything that I can at that moment. I wound up about a year ago actually renting a cabin on a lake, and my plan is always to get out to the cabin to write by 1. And if I can be out there by 2:30, I'm happy. And then I get out there and there's no phone there. There's no way that anyone can contact me. Put on some music and sit and write. And that goes until 6:30. Then I come back. And then I deal with emergencies coming in from the West Coast. Because by that point, that's when I talk to my CAA agent and find out what's happening with what movie script and what option and stuff like that.
And you seem remarkably calm through all of this.
Oh, it's an illusion, actually. Inside, I'm a gibbering, what's name? gibber.
And do we know what the next book is, or are you dreaming about it now?
Actually, the next book, for once, and I say this for once because it's probably the only time in my life this actually will be true, the next book is not only already written, but actually was handed in a year ago. And it was a book that I'd been working on. I started writing it in about 1990, and I finished it in around April last year. I got stuck on American Gods. I'm trying to remember where I was in the book. I think we just left Cairo, and I wasn't quite, and I needed a week or two off just to figure everything out. And I stopped and I finished this book, which I'd been writing a little bit at a time for many years. And I suddenly looked up and it was the middle of May 2000, and I had a book that nobody was waiting for. And I sent it in to Harper and they said, we love it. And I said, well, you could publish it instead of publishing American Gods this year so that I won't be, you know, you'll have a book already. And they said, you know what, we'll wait for American Gods and we'll publish this afterwards. So it's a book called Coraline, and it's about 30,000 words long, which is not long. It's about half the length of a normal novel. And it's a very, very creepy story about a little girl named Coraline who one day goes through a door in her house that is normally bricked up, because it's a big old house that was converted into lots of flats, and one day there aren't any bricks in the way, and she goes through, and she finds herself in a flat that looks a lot like the one that she left, and waiting for her in the kitchen are her other mother and her other father, and they look just like the ones that she left behind, only they're much taller and whiter, and their hair moves very slowly all the time, and they have long fingers, and they have big black buttons for eyes, and they want her to stay with them for always. And it's a story of what happens and how she escapes. And it's a really cool, very, very creepy novel. The strange thing about it, for me as a writer, which really is strange, is adults read it as a horror story. Adults read it and are creeped out. Adults get nightmares. Kids read it as an adventure story. Kids find it a lot less traumatic.
Interesting.
And I have no idea why that is. I think kids, because kids go into a story going, everything's going to be fine. You know, of course you've got a heroine. She's going to get out of this just fine. Adults are never quite so sure.
Well, Neil, I want to thank you again for visiting with us today here in Recorded Books. And I don't want to keep you because I know very shortly you're going to be on a plane to Rio.
To Rio de Janeiro, yes. Well, I'll be signing books at the Rio Book Festival. So.
Do you have a South American pseudonym?
No, it's just Neil Kamen.
Neil Kamen.
Yes. Actually, there is a little town in Argentina, in Patagonia, called Gaiman. And the last time I was in Argentina, several years ago, at the end of the trip, I flew down to Trelew. And there's this weird little Welsh community, and it's down there. And I went out for the day to Gaiman in Patagonia. And I kept buying, you know, these really cheap and tacky mugs and things, these awful tourist things. We all said Gaiman on them. And people would say, oh, you know, what do you want with this? And I would say, well, it's actually, you know, I'd show them my credit card. And they would slap their thighs. They thought it was the best joke in the world. It's Mr. Gaiman from Gaiman. We're in Gaiman. This is wonderful. So
you have another short story.
Exactly.
Is that a Welsh name?
No. It's one of those Jewish names that managed to transliterate as it crossed, you know, it started out in Poland or somewhere, and, you know, it would have been a Cheyman at that point, and then the G got hard as it crossed the channel into England, and then my grandmother decided she wanted it spelt like this. It had lots of E's in it originally. I only know this because I found the engagement invitation and the wedding invitation, and I said, Grandpa's name's spelt differently on this. And she said, oh, yes, dear, I changed it. I didn't like the way he spelt it before. And I thought, that must have been much more fun back then when you could just change your name because that was, you know, you'd respell your name because you thought it looked better. These days, I think you have to do it all very formally.
Thank you again for visiting with us today, Neil.
You are very welcome. Thank you very much.
For Recorded Books, this is Denise Longteau.
You've been listening to The Author Talks, a conversation with Neil Gaiman, hosted by Denise Longteau. Recorded Books is pleased to offer an unabridged recording of American Gods, narrated by George Guidel. You'll find a wide selection of titles on cassette and CD in the Recorded Books catalog. So call us toll-free using the telephone number found on this package. On our website, you can browse the catalog, hear about the latest releases, or tune into narrator profiles and other author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.